Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God. And we're going to be looking at Genesis again. We've gone through Genesis 34, and we've done some of the later chapters. We've almost caught up with where we originally started looking at Genesis. And those recordings are up. The side panel has study links so that you can find out more about these individual verses and the message in them. But to find out what was going on then is studying the past. And I always say, if you want to know the future, study the past. Because where we've been, it tells us a lot about where we're going, depending on how we see the history of events back then. And of course, the Bible is historical to some degree, but it's also an allegory. And so it has all kinds of names. They're very fond of changing the names of individuals to mean something different to them. And they do this in the Hebrew, adding letters and taking letters away and switching letters around in order to make words mean something more than what you might think on the surface. This is very hard to translate into English because we don't do that in English, which is why you can look up, you know, a given word like Kadesh, which has a Strong's number of 6942. It's a primitive word. It has a kuf, delet, a shin in it. And what does it mean? Sanctify, hallow, dedicate, holy, prepare, consecrate, appointed, purified. You know, it has seven other miscellaneous translations. And that's an easy word, a fairly easy word to look at. To sanctify, hallow, those kind of seem a little bit the same. Dedicate, that gives you a little bit more meaning to the word. And but you'll have words that are translated dozens of different ways, but they're also having many other letters added to them. Now, sometimes these letters seem to correlate with the syntax of the sentence. But there's so many different layers to these words and to these phrases, and they're put together, and even when they're written down, there's not always the spacing between them, and you don't know, is this letter the end of that one or the beginning of this one? And the fact is that every sentence is a composite of ideas, and every word is a composite of ideas because every letter has a meaning. We don't do that in English. We don't think in that way in English. But we do have stories that are allegories. And we do use metaphors every day in our language. So common to us that we don't even think about it being a metaphor. But when you're going from one language to the other, you can lose a lot. You can miss a lot of what is in a particular language or what is intended by the author. And that's what we want to find out, is what is intended by the author. But do we want to do it looking at the Bible as a source of knowledge? Because the Bible is going to tell us what the truth is. When we have those kind of ideas in our head, we're actually climbing around in the tree of knowledge. You know, I remember an atheist arguing with somebody who was supposedly a scholar and talking about, well, evidently, your God doesn't want us to have any knowledge. No, he gave us the tree of knowledge. He wants us to have knowledge. He doesn't want it to be the source of our decisions. The knowledge is information. But, you know, like you can have information on how to make a gun or load bullets and make bullets, and you can have that knowledge of how to do that. That's fine, but how do you use that gun? how to use those bullets. Is that a matter of knowledge? You know, there's a Japanese, I think they also do it in China, where they practice with a bow, and they prepare the bow, and they pull back the arrow, and then they look away from the target. They look in the opposite direction, and then they fire at the target, and they can hit it. And what is telling them when to pull that and let go of the string and let that arrow fly? There's some people who are very remarkable with a bow. I mean, they shoot through rings. They split arrows. They put a dozen arrows in the air at one time towards a target. Just phenomenal skill. And do they calculate all that out with knowledge and information? Or is it muscle memory? Or is there something more to it? I mean, some of the uncanny ability of people to hit the target under conditions that shouldn't allow you to do that is astounding. I know there's more going on in these situations than simply skill. That the skill includes more than the senses that we normally depend upon. Well, this is the same thing that Abraham is. He looks around him. He sees what everybody else is doing all around him. Now, there's a few people evidently doing things differently than what we see Nimrod doing and Terah doing and Abimelech doing. And Abraham is trying to find his way. And then Isaac and then Jacob. And now we're up to Genesis 35. I mean, we're looking through the Genesis 34, and we studied a great deal of that, Dinah, and the Shechem, which means consent. The name of the individual that falls in love with Dinah is consent. That's his name. That's what it means. And somehow he had relations, some sort of relations with Dinah, and that upset the sons of Jacob. Jacob was keeping his peace, and they were going to deal with Shechem and his father, and they seemed to be wanting to bend over backwards because he really loved Dinah. He wanted to make her his wife, and Hamor and Shechem and the people of their city were all going to be willing to, the men were going to get circumcised, and the people were going to start following the ways of Jacob, and they were going to become an allied people. But two of the sons treated them subtly. And we looked at that word subtly, which we find in Jeremiah 9:6. Thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. Once you start acting subtly or deceitfully, which is the way we see it in chapter 34, where two of the brothers, Simeon and Levi, went in and committed genocide. Instead of making a peace treaty and actually them not just being separate and, you know, like with Abimelech, who was separate, doing his own thing, not what Abraham was doing, but and not what Isaac was doing, but agreed that they could do what they were doing and he would leave them unmolested. These guys were actually going to become a part of Israel to meet the qualifications of Israel. And the whole city was going to be an ally of Israel. And two of the sons, at least two of the sons, Simeon and Levi, betrayed them because they acted subtly, deceitfully. Well, later on, we've already gone through these studies where these same sons and the other sons do the same thing, mistreating Joseph and selling him into bondage and telling their father that he must have been killed by animals, which is also dishonest. But it says here, or at least in Jeremiah 9:6, that the habitation is in the midst of deceit. They're using deceit. and through deceit they refuse to know me. The fact is, they cannot know God if you will not see the truth. You cannot be born again unless you love the light that shines on the truth, until you are willing to see the whole truth and provide for it. You cannot really be born again. You can have a religious experience. You can begin the process of repentance and turn around and go back the other way. But you're not really born again. You may delude yourselves into thinking that you're born again. But if you read that, where they talk about that in John, and you read a little bit farther, there's qualifying verses that if you don't love the light and you're still a worker of iniquity, then you're probably not born again. You just may be under what the Bible also calls a strong delusion, because you've deceived yourself. And if you deceived yourself, you cannot know him. And even the Greeks knew that first you have to know yourself in order to know God, to know anything. Whether you pluck it from the tree of knowledge or not. Because there's lots of people who go out and get educated, get all kinds of knowledge, go to the same school. They could be twin brothers and go to the same school, learn all the same things, read all the same books, have all the same information, and come to a different conclusion. Because one eats of the tree of life and the other one chooses darkness. Chooses darkness like Adam and Eve. Once they did wrong, they didn't want to admit it, and they hid from God. They refused to know God, to see God, to look upon God. And then God puts a light in the tree of life and they flee the garden. If we want to get back to the tree of life, to know the truth, the whole truth, and provide for it, we need to see the whole truth. Simon and Levi were not really willing to see that. Jacob warns them, "Ye have troubled me to make me stink." And when you look through those words, and we have links on the page at preparingyou.com where you can read more about this, and eventually we're going to have the audios up that take you through step by step. But he says that I'm going to be destroyed. I and my whole house is going to be destroyed because of what you've done. And they made excuses. Should he deal with our sister as with a harlot? But that's not what he was trying to do. He wanted to marry her. He wanted her to be his wife. And he was willing to get circumcised, change his whole way of life to do this, to be converted to the ways of Jacob. But you know, the ways of Jacob were not yet quite perfect. I mean, he was going to be called Israel, but there were still things he didn't know to do, or still things that he did that he probably shouldn't be doing. And that's where we're going to find ourselves as we get into chapter 35. Is that right away, we see at the beginning of that chapter, "And God said unto Jacob," God's talking to Jacob. "He said unto Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother." So he's back to building these altars. An altar to God. What kind of an altar is that? What is he actually going to be doing? What are altars actually all about? And why is that going to help him out? Because he stinks and fears destruction. You know, we see the word arise there. Kum. It's kuf, vav, mem. And it can mean arise, or just get up, or stand up, raise up. But it can also mean establish, stand, perform, confirm, Now, Jacob is starting to do things differently, but now he has to confirm. It's actually even it translated abide in one place. And he wants him to go to Bethel. What does Bethel mean? It's the house of God. He wants him to go to the house of God. It's an actual location, because he goes and describes that he wants him to go to this place where God appeared unto thee when thou fleddest the face of Esau. So he doesn't want him to go to a place. But is there a town called Bethel, or is it he's saying go to the house of God? He's going to something that means, because it's actually two words, Bethel. You know, Beit has to do with household. And so we see that right away, that he's going to Beit Yad Tav. Tav is faith. So he's going to the house of God, but it's actually the house of faith in God. That's what Bethel really means. If we're going to go in deeper and look for the meaning. So he's got to go and confirm the house of God and dwell there. And we see that word dwell lots of times. And it show, or abide. It can be translated abide. We see, if you go back to John, or up forward to John 12, 45, 46, and he that seeth me seeth him that sent me. I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believeth on me should not abide in darkness. At that particular time that John was writing this, when Jesus came, the people were sitting in darkness. And we could go to, you know, Isaiah 62 and Isaiah 9, and or Isaiah 9, that was a good place, 9 verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God. He's actually going to be called the Mighty God. This child born is going to be called the Mighty God, Everlasting Father. He's called a father. But he prays to his Father in heaven, if we're talking about Jesus Christ. He's also called the Prince of Peace. He's also righteous. And he's a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, who is the righteous King of Peace. And he's called the Prince of Peace. So all these ideas are swimming around in this one verse where it says he's got lots of names. But this is supposedly clearly a reference to Jesus. And we see in verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David. And who is Jesus? The highest son of David. Upon his kingdom. What does this kingdom look like? What is this kingdom? To order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And they talk in the very next verse about Jacob. And the Lord sent a word unto Jacob. That's what we were just reading in Genesis 35, that God is talking to him. And it hath lighted upon Israel. And Israel is the place where God prevails. And in the news, we're hearing about a peace treaty in the land called Israel today, with people who are called Israelis. And we've talked about that. You know, what was Jacob doing? And shouldn't anybody who is an Israelite or a follower of Israel or a follower of Jacob, follower of Abraham, should also be doing like Melchizedek? They should have a government like that to know if, and, you know, like I say, if everybody who says they're following Abraham and everybody who says they're following Moses and everybody who says they're following Jesus Christ there should be no conflict between them. And that's a lot of people. But is there conflict between them? If we go up to verse 2 in Isaiah, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell, there's that word dwell again, in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. Now Jacob is going to be traveling through the land, and his sons have made him stink, and he's concerned that he will be destroyed. He's literally walking through the valley of the shadow of death. And a lot of people think that, oh, we're bringing peace to the Middle East because we have a treaty, a league, some sort of agreement. And they're celebrating in the Gaza. That, you know, the people are celebrating that they're, and I guess there's supply trucks moving in. What was the number? Lots of semis just loaded with food and supplies. Now, how are they going to operate and distribute that? I hope they have a network like Abraham had, like Moses had, that is dependent upon from the ground up, from the people gathering together, and not as some sort of controlled handout by a central government where they're going to hand you free bread from a central government. They're bringing in an offering of and sacrifice that is coming by way of trucks. Well, Jacob's going to have offerings and sacrifice. That's why he's building an altar. And he talks in verse 5, for every battle of the warrior is with confused noise, the garments rolled in blood, but this shall be with burning and fuel of fire. What else is burning and brings fire? Well, the smoking furnace and the burning lamp, also, which is part of the vision. And if we go back even one more verse to verse 4, for thou hast broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder and the rod of his oppressor and the day of Midian. And so the previous verse talks about dividing the spoils and joy in the harvest and all these sorts of things. And we'll go and we'll study Isaiah, if God willing, and he gives us the time to do it. But in 35, you know, the people all around him are not doing what he's doing. And they finally had somebody who wanted to do what he was doing, and his sons betrayed them and literally kill him. Horrible. Genocide. Wiped them all out. Because they dealt deceitfully. Let's hope this treaty that is being made is not full of deceit also. And all you need is one side. Because Shechem and his father, they weren't deceiving anybody. It was Simeon and Levi who were deceiving. And they would end up going for this offense and others. They would end up going into bondage for 400 years. Until they learned their lessons. So that they could come out of the bondage of Egypt. And be a free people under God. But they, you know, once they operated with deceit, they weren't going to know God. They were going to be deceived. But we'll be right back and explore this more. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So Jacob is hearing from God. He's hearing this voice from God, and we just saw in Isaiah that this was part of the prediction of Christ coming. The very next verse had to do with Jacob hearing from God, and Jacob's concerned again. Now, he was concerned when Esau was coming with 400 men, and he was trying to make preparations to protect his family, you know, gonna have Leah and the others out in front and Rachel back here, you know, and he decided, no, I'm going to put them all together. But only after he heard from God. He went and prayed and heard from God and knew that he could trust God. He had prayed and said, you know, I'm concerned, I'm worried, I'm afraid. And, of course, that's one of the first commandments of God over and over again whenever he converses with anybody is fear not. Because fear draws you into the dark side, draws you into the darkness. That's why Adam and Eve fled the garden. Because they feared the light. You have to flee to the light and not fear God. Because God is not a God of fear. He's not going to get people to follow him because they're afraid of him, but because they respect him. And that's very important. So Jacob is given several directives. Arise, go to the house of God, the house of faith in God, and dwell there. And this dwell, abide there, has to do with, you know, living in Canaan, but not of Canaan, not of the ways of Canaan, not of the tables of Abimelech, and not of the tables of Bera, king of Sodom. He would stop short of the city of Sychem. He would not enter that. He would not become a part of their city. They wanted to come out and become a part of him. What was going on in these cities? I mean, eventually we'll see lots of city-states have golden statues. And of course, there was a problem with a golden calf that was made. And it was made out of what? When people broke off their earrings and made a golden calf. We've got articles where you can go look up what's the golden calf. It's a central bank. That's literally what it is. They call it the reserve fund in the Greek. And they actually saw off parts of it sometimes in order to buy what they need to make war, to defend their city-states or to build walls around their city-states. And it's called a reserve fund because it also includes their social welfare. You had to have systems of social welfare in these city-states in order to create loyalty. A lot of people would gather in the city-states, make the agreement, whatever you had to agreement you had to make. If, you know, if Bera was your king or whoever, or Abimelech was your father king, you had to have some sort of an agreement that, okay, you know, like they did in Egypt, 20% of my labor is going to belong to the Pharaoh. But the Pharaoh is going to provide me with daily bread in the time of famine. But he's also going to offer protection. Early Americans, they were to protect one another. And of course, in the Judeo-Christian ethic, we have to love our neighbor as ourselves. That means when our neighbor's in trouble, we have to come to their aid. In a righteous sort of way that strengthens the poor. And this includes both physically coming to protect them from being murdered or robbed or whatever, but also to protect them from starvation. And there's different ways to do that. Set up those systems. They both have altars or tables, they call them. We see that word a lot. There is a table that should have been for your welfare, but is a snare. David writes that. Paul quotes that in the New Testament. Those tables are altars. Jesus tips over tables. And Peter appoints seven men to wait on tables. In the Greek, the word table is trapezia. If you go to Greece today and you say, I want to cash this check, where is a bank? You'll say, where is a trapezia? Because it's the same word. It's even translated bank in the Bible. It's also translated table. Well, it might be confusing if you didn't understand that there was a treasury in the temple and Jesus was tipping over the tables, the banks. And we have an article on that, the money changers. Go read that article. Find out more about what was really going on. Because eventually Rome would conquer Jerusalem well after Jesus had left and Christianity was already forming its way. And they would confiscate all the gold that was in the bank, in the temple, and go build the Colosseum. All a matter of history. But what's going on here in verse 2? Then Jacob said unto his household, which is not just his wives, it's all the people that are following them. And there's lots of people following them. And to all that were with him. That's what he says right there. All that were with him. There's a lot of people with him. And they're dwelling in booths. This is one of the unusual things. Not that tents were unusual, but it's unusual about Moses, unusual about Jacob, that every man worshiped from his own booth, his own tent, his own tabernacle, his own house. What worship means serve. They serve from that. How do they do that? This is how they bind a whole nation together, because their social welfare was not in physical walls, but in a way of righteousness. But he's all of a sudden telling them, put away the strange gods. And they repeat it, strange gods. He repeats it in the text. He says it twice. That are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. We just read, you know, in Isaac, talking about garments with blood. You know, just like they talk about, you know, biting one another in the New Testament, lest you be devoured. You know, just like they talk about the cauldron. Let's build us a city, and the city will be our cauldron, and we will be the flesh in there. And these, of course, are eventually called the cities of blood. Now he's talking about putting on clean garments. And we've talked about the statues that were hidden under the seat of Rachel that she stole from her father Laban, who didn't know that somebody had stole those statues until he went to shear his sheep. And of course, we know that he was following the ways of Nahor, and Nahor was following the ways of Terah, and Terah was an idolater who made statues originally for Nimrod. And the system of Nimrod, the system of Babylon. What were these statues? These are the local governors. How will you maintain control? The local governors. I will give them, I'll make you a governor, you get a statue. I'll make you a governor, you get a statue. And of course, the governors will have their tax collectors go out and say, I'm a tax collector for Terah. You know, I've come to get your share of the taxes. Well, how do I know you're a tax collector? Well, I have this statue. And you recognize that. I mean, he's not going to have a document that has words written out on it. Most people didn't read. But he's got that statue. And that gives him the authority to collect the tax, to shear the sheep, to collect the funds that's going to run the government of Laban. Laban was always interested in the gold, but the people were his possession. Bera did the same thing. Bera had his own kingdom, but he also was allied with other kings. Suddenly, him and a bunch of guys said, we're not going to pay tribute anymore. We're going to still tax our people, but we're not going to depend on you. There's no real threat out there. Well, guess what? They came to collect what you owe them. And they and Barrow fled. Every country in the world today is in debt. So who owes what to who? But Jacob just dwelled in the land. He didn't eat at the tables of Abimelech. He gave gifts to Esau and his 400 men who are marching around the countryside, and probably hundreds and hundreds of more people that were following. It was 400 men. Men have families. Families have sons. So there was, and he ends up, we'll see in the next chapter, where he goes and he's not camping where Jacob is camping. He goes somewhere else. But Jacob is saying, put away your strange gods. You know, and then he also says, break off your earrings. Wow. That's from, and cleanse your garments. We're going to do something different here. We're going to have clean garments, not garments of blood. Not the dependent upon these other systems. We're going to put our whole faith in God. We're going to go to Bethel. Bethel. Be it. Eliph. Tov. El. You know, that, I mean, you can actually look at, if you go to the preparing you, you know, I have the word Bethel, house of God. That's the way they define it. You know, they also say it's an ancient place, a seat of worship. And worship, again, is service. A seat of service. Not far from Beersheba, the well of satisfaction. But the letters are, be it Yod, Tav, be it purpose, dwelling place, Yod, infinite point, you know, the divine spark, Tav, seal of the higher kingdom. It's the realm through faith. A realm established through faith. The crown of sovereignty from the tree of life, spiritually linking worlds or realms through the unseen doorway of faith. That's the letter defined there in the word Bethel. And followed by Eliph Lamad. Eliph, father-son relationship, the paradox of God and man, that connection, and Lamad, the aspiration of the heart. And together they are El. You know, Elohim. And so that's where he's going. That's where he's going to take the people. But we got to get rid of these strange gods that we had our faith in before. So you can put your faith in a talisman, an object, or an institution. And that's a form of idolatry. But if you're really going to walk with God, you have to put your faith in a spiritual relationship with God. And that's going to include these altars unto God. And he says, let us arise and go up to Bethel. Now God has told him to do this. Now he's telling the people, we're going to go up to the house of God. We're going to go up to, according to the way of God. And we'll make there an altar unto God. And we won't need these statues and earrings that are linked. The earrings, again, connect you with what you have faith in. It was part of almost an ID system. Just like, you know, they talk about braiding of hair in the New Testament. Women are to braid their hair. Well, you braided your hair to show that you were a part of a particular group. It was like gang colors almost. And this group did things a certain way, had a certain culture, certain way of worshiping, certain system of worship that created a social welfare system and a system of protection, which would eventually require a system of courts and appeals courts, which we explain Israel had. The cities of refuge were appeals courts. If you didn't get away with murder because you were a fast runner, you could appeal to the cities of refuge. And that's, it wasn't a matter of fast runners get to get away with murder. As it's, they're metaphors, they're describing. And those appeals courts were manned by men of charity, because the entire government of Israel under Moses was supported by free will offerings. There was no tax. There was a free will offering. There was a reference to a little bit of a poll tax, head tax, that you give once a year to say, yeah, I'm still with you guys. But that was a tiny little token, and anybody could pay it for you. Say if you didn't have the money and people wanted to still include you as being a part, it's just a way of saying, yeah, I'm a part of the network. Every year, I should give something. And these are systems by which societies bound themselves together. Well, there was another system. Nimrod had a system. Abimelech had a system. Bera had a system. And you would swear allegiance. It wasn't about faith. It was about allegiance. But it also brought you into bondage. Now, some city-states had more bondage than others. And, of course, Jacob wasn't running. He was allowing people to have their own homes, their own booths. It wasn't for his livestock. It was for all those people following him. That's why we went through that and showed you the word that he used in reference to these booths. He wasn't building tents for his cows and his sheep. He was allowing the people to have their own dwellings. They were following him, but he wasn't making slaves of men. He was setting men free. Well, this is another part of that process. To go to the house of God and build an altar unto God, who answered me in the days of my distress and was with me in the way which I went. Told him where to go. You go this way, go that way. I've explained that, how you do that. If you can listen to the Lord, How do you listen to the Lord? Well, you have to get deceit out of the way. Because if you're full of deceit, if you're deceiving yourself, if you're lying to yourself, if you're embracing the delusion, if you're comfortable in the dark, not knowing, you're not going to know which way to go. And people are somewhat dependent upon Jacob to figure out which way to go, but he wants them to have that individual choice from their individual households. Because family is the institution of God. Governments are often the institution of men. And there's a division between the sacrifices of the governments of the world and the government of God. And so, in verse 4, he says, and they gave, they use the word forgive is Nathan. I have a son named Nathan. Nun, Tov, Nun. And that's, but here they have Vav, Yod, a divine spark again, Tov, which we just saw that in Bethel, in the word Bethel itself, Yod, Tov, Nun, Vav. And Nun again is the fish swimming in the sea. So this giving is in motion. It's, and they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods, these statues that represent authorities with other people, because lots of people are following them. And they may want to keep their connection to the old way. And he's saying, no, we're going to have to get rid of the old way. We're not going to depend upon the strange gods or the tables that should be for our welfare but are actually a snare. We're going to make a commitment to walk and dwell in the ways of God. So the strange gods that were in their hands, they were going to turn them over to Jacob or go their own way. And all their earrings. And it's a big long word for earrings there too. You know, hey, Nun, Chet, Yod, Mem, which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak, which was by Shechem. And Shechem again is the word for consent. The oak which is by consent. So he hid them. They're giving these things up and giving consent. And they're hiding them under an oak, a terebinth. This actual word there that shows up. I've talked about it several times. Very difficult thing for a lot of people to see. You know, the oak has to do with strength. It also has to do with, the root word is ilah. But it's, one commentary says the oak, the terebinth, it is noteworthy that Joshua, under the same oak of Shechem, oak of consent, because you could read it that way as well. I mean, in the Hebrew, you can see that it's the same word. We see it also in Joshua 24, verse 26, testified against the primitive worship of strange gods. What they call it primitive worship, but it's the worship that Babylon does, where you're a member and you owe an allegiance and you pay in. I mean, Abraham was tithing to Melchizedek. He wasn't tithing to Abimelech, because he was a dweller. He was a stranger in the land. He was a stranger to the ways of Abimelech. But Abimelech said, this is a good guy. God is with him. God is protecting him. I'm going to, not molest him. I'm going to consider him a friend, which is why there was the sacrifice of the red heifer, but we won't go into that now, that Israel was to have the sacrifice of the red heifer. Had nothing to do with the color red, had nothing to do with a heifer that was all red. That they have unmoored the metaphor. If you want to find out really what it was, well, go find out. It's if Israel was already sacrificing the red heifer, there wouldn't have had to been so many people die in Gaza. Both Israelis and people who live in Gaza. Many people could have survived if they understood what the sacrifice of the red heifer was. But now the trucks are rolling, evidently. But anyway, we're going to keep going and see if we can get in deeper and deeper and understand this journey. Because right away in the next verses, 5, and they journeyed. And the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. So because of what he was doing, they were now afraid to attack him. And I could give you lots of stories where people might have wanted to molest somebody or hurt them, and they were afraid to do it. And they couldn't even tell you why. Because Jacob, this is a major decision to dwell, to give up these strange gods, to give up the, they didn't make a golden calf with the earrings. But they were no longer going to depend upon them. But they hid them under this oak of consent. And I keep saying going back to consent, because the word Shechem there means consent. And we'll talk more about the oak later. But so Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan. And Canaan is, again, the merchants of men, the men that make men human resources. Bera made men human resources. Abimelech made men human resources. Cain would have made men human resources. Laban saw people as human resources. Nahor did, because the system of idolatry is, according to Paul, idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry. So they have systems, a common purse, one purse, where somebody collects a tax and takes care of the needy of society and also funds the army. Saul tried that. Tried to force an offering to supply for the army. And Samuel said he was foolish. His kingdom wouldn't stand. And such systems always eventually collapse under decay and corruption. But the systems that are bound together by faith, hope, and charity, that's an everlasting kingdom. But a lot of people have strayed from that. There's a lot of charitable people out there, and a lot of people that want to have faith in Christ, in the way of Christ, but they're not being told. They're kept in the dark about the way of Christ. And we need to turn around and head towards the light and find out. So he's going to lose in Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him, at least with him still. But we'll be right back to Keys of the Kingdom and take a deeper look. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So he's on his way to Luz, which there's actually two places in Israel with the name of Luz, but the same exact word also means an almond, like an almond grove. And maybe there was an almond grove there. Some of the historians think that there was a city called Luz that was near this site of Bethel. And of course, if somebody built an almond grove and had lots of people around, people had to gather together to create their own kind of reliance, because you can't do it all yourself. You had to have other people. You know, somebody's going to make this thing, and somebody's going to make that thing, and they're going to be good at it. And even Indian tribes, there were people who just chipped flint all the time because they could make the best arrowheads. And they would trade, you know, somebody would go out hunting, and they would, you know, maybe lose an arrow or break a tip or something like that, and they'd come in, and they'd have a game, and they would give extra to the guy or the gal who was making good arrowheads. And they would give them some of the meat, and they would take the arrowheads in exchange. You know, that wampum, that's what wampum, to some degree, was your trade good. And, of course, some people made beaded goods that would be considered of value and could be a trade good, and you could wear it as part of your garment, and it was like money. And they made an exchange. But anyway, the point is this Luz, which also means almond, and there are other words that are very similar to it. You know, it's Lamad, Vav, Zayin, and so, Zayin, and so it's, but it appears to be a place near Bethel. And of course, Bethel really wasn't a place. It was the house of God. Now, they marked the place with a pillar, and then we can have a study on what pillars are, but he marked it with a pillar. He set that up right when he was there before, but now he's going to build an altar there. So what's that all about? And when they build this altar, they're going to have different garments, and garments is covering. And basically, their covering is going to be God, because they're building an altar to God. And God is going to protect them. And he's telling us that when they were traveling on their journey, that people feared them because the terror of God. I mean, the word terror there. It's hey, tov, tov. That's the word that they have there for terror. So there's a double tov. Because now they weren't just going to have faith in God, but they were going to have faith in God in spirit and truth. So they were going to have this. I mean, the normal word that would mean terror is chet tov hey. But in the text we find chet tov tov. So that's important to understand that there's a different, that it's a different spelling. It's the terror of God, because they were now journeying in faith, and that was faith in spirit and truth, in tov tov, the double tov. And of course we have a whole study on why double letters suddenly show up. Now, people will conjecture that, oh, maybe it's just syntax, or maybe, and there's a huge number of rules about syntax and why they move certain letters around and everything. And there is some kind of pattern and consistency, but I see a different pattern when I look at the letters. That they were now going to have more faith in God than just saying, I have faith in God, the God Yahweh, the God of creation, this monotheistic God, thinking that all of creation is under some sort of supreme divine designer. And we put names on it, like we were just reading there in Isaiah, that there are all these, you know, Prince of Peace, Wonderful Counselor, Melchizedek. It's a title. It's not his name. He's the they call him the Righteous King of Salem, of Peace. It's a title. And Jesus is a king and priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, the Righteous King of Peace. His government operates on free will offerings. In order to collect those free will offerings, you don't need an idol, a badge, a statue, you know, documents proving that you're working for Nimrod or you're working for Caesar or you're working for Pharaoh. Because everybody worships, everybody serves through free will offerings. This Moses required this. Abraham operated that way. He was tithing. He wasn't, like I say, wasn't tithing to Nimrod. He wasn't tithing to Abimelech. He was tithing to the Righteous King of Peace, the guy who only was supported by free will offerings. And now the people following him are going to support his journey with free will offerings. And this is going to create the social bonds of a free society according to the perfect law of liberty. If you don't do it that way, you may find yourself biting the bait of bondage, which is what we're going to talk about on X. If you're following us on X, His Holy Church on X, they give you a notice of when we're going to have another X space where you can ask questions, you can challenge us. We'll give you a mic and you can ask questions. And that's the topic, the bait and the bondage. Well, now he's holding out bait too, but it's going to depend upon free will offerings on this altar that he is building. And we see in verse 7, and he built there, he established there an altar and called the place El Bethel. El Bethel, God, house of God, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. There's that oak again. And the name of it was called Alan Bat-Truth. And we could go into that. Why that? Why is this oak? Was it really, you know, it's really, I don't know if you've been around with many oak trees. If you want to bury somebody under an oak, you better bring an axe. Because you're going to have to get through the roots. And if there's any kind of rocks there, it's going to be quite the chore. And does it really have anything to do with burying somebody under an oak? Well, you can believe that. That's fine. But if you want to go deeper, you're going to have to find out what this oak stands for. And so anyway, he built this altar. And he called it El Bethel. And we see God, and God appeared unto Jacob again. And it says appeared unto Jacob. So what's the word there for appear? Resh, Eleph, Hey would be the normal word. But we see Vav, Yod, Resh, Eleph is the actual word that we find in the text. Not Resh, Eleph, Hey, which would mean see, or look or behold, but they're telling us something more. I mean, the original vav is probably translated in the word and. And God appeared unto Jacob somehow when he came out of Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And so now that's Israel. Because of what Jacob is doing, building this altar that receives free will offerings from the people living in their own booths, that are following him by consent, and they're agreeing under an oak, a strong tree. And so in verse 11, and God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And then he says something that people quote, like to quote today, and the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. And why? Because he's Israel. But why is he Israel? Because he built an altar that was going to depend upon free will offerings and not systems that exercise authority one over the other and shear the people, turn the people into human resources, make the people subject, literally make them merchandise, where you can borrow money against the future of their labor, which would curse their children. All they're the systems of covetous practices that we see Nimrod. And covetousness is idolatry, so we call them idolaters. Terah was an idolater because he had this system of authority. And the authority was represented in the statues. And they would make little statues for the little guys. You know, they'd be made out of clay, and many of them have survived through archaeology. And you would show, well, you know, this statue, and they recognize this statue. And I was talking to my granddaughter. There's an old movie, Hobson's Choice. He was a shoemaker. And out in front of Hobson's, they had the sign Hobson, so you'd know this is the shoemaker Hobson. But only if you could read. But you could see what was hanging below the sign, which was a boot. And you say, well, that I can see that sign from here, that's a bootmaker. And when we do, if you want to find a McDonald's, you look for a golden arches. And these become symbols. And so that's what those statues were symbols. They could also be, if they were made of silver or made of gold, usually if they were made of gold, this was a bigger city-state, and it was the reserve fund. It was the bank. It was the money in the bank, because you weren't going to count all those coins every night, but you could see, well, the statue's still there. These are systems, and Jacob was creating a different system. Because of that, he was called Israel by God. Just like Jesus is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Because he was the Prince of Peace. And therefore the King, the righteous King of Peace. So we see this where, you know, God is making him Israel. And God said unto him, I am Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, and nations will come out of your loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. What land? Now you can, what are they, from the river to the sea. they have these, but there's a metaphor here. The land that was given to Abraham, you can find the quote yourself, was wherever he walked. this man of faith. He was called a man of faith in the New Testament because he walked by faith. He lived by faith. His altars were fed by faith, not by force, but by faith and charity and hope. You know, you cast your bread upon the waters and hope that they may come back to you someday. And when he was walking through the land, dwelling in the land, he was hoping that God would protect him, and he did. And the people were beginning to see this, some of them. And some of them stayed with him. I'm sure some probably left eventually. I don't know, there's no reference to it, but there's a lot of things they leave out of these very short stories. So, the land is, if you live by faith, you're going to own the land. If you don't live by faith, you're not going to own the land, which is why I wrote the book Covenants of the Gods, in the chapter Law versus Legal, and why is that so? But we don't have time to go through that right now. So God went up from him in place where he talked with him. So they don't say anything about what God looked like. Was he an angel? Was he, you know, was it the same guy he wrestled with? And there's a lot of confusion as to who he wrestled, because it says man in the translation, but the word there is not the normal word for man. It's a very complicated, long word. Later on, Hosea, they refer to it as an angel. So, I mean, what was the wrestling match all about? You have to be careful you don't fill in those blanks with your own imagery, because that's idolatry. You want to understand the principles of what Jacob was struggling with, because now the sons are going to have to do the same struggle. So, and Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone. Now, why do they say he set up a pillar, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon? We have an article on drink offering, which you can go to. And he poured oil thereon. So he anoints this place. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him Bethel. I thought he was going to Bethel. No, now he's calling the place Bethel, but he was going to the house of God. And the house of God is supported by free will offerings, because it operates according to the perfect law of liberty. So if you're created an institution that does not operate according to the perfect law of liberty, that's not the house of God, that's another house. It may be the house of Babylon. You might not know it, so we'll call it Mystery Babylon. That you're actually serving Mystery Babylon, and you become a human resource in Sodom. A human resource in Mystery Babylon. Merchandise belonging to them. And if you don't want to admit that, well, then you are deceiving yourself. You may be deceiving yourself. I don't know where you live, but you may be deceiving yourself. And if you're deceiving yourself, you can't know God. So you have to see the truth. You have to be willing to accept the truth and see the truth. Verse 16, and they journeyed from Bethel, the place now, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath. And Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass that when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said unto her, fear not, thou shalt have this son also. So the midwife says, you're going to give birth. And it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, which means sorrow. But his father, Jacob, called him Benjamin, which means the right hand. And Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave, and is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. And verse 21, and Israel journeyed, he's called Israel now, Israel and all the people that are following the ways of Israel would be also called Israel, and spread his tent beyond the Tower of Edar. Now, there's a meaning there, but we won't go into it right now. But it's also a place. But they don't just, they're naming these places as we go. Because there was no place called Bethel until he named it. Verse 22, and it came to pass when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went to lay with Bila, his father's concubine. And Israel heard it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. And they include that part of it in this verse 22. But I would think they'd want to put it down in verse 23. But somebody numbered these. It wasn't Moses. But he heard it. Shama is the normal word that you would find for understand. It actually is translated obedient, diligent, show, sound, declare, discern, noise, perceive, tell, reported, and 33 other miscellaneous different ways. But it's not really spelled Shin Mim An in the text. That's the base word. But it's spelled Vav Yad Shin Mim An. So again, there's that divine spark put there in before the Shin. So he heard it, but he heard it through the ears that God is giving him. And what does he do about it? Well, there's, to be honest, I'll give you a heads up. There's a lot of people that say this doesn't mean that he slept with Bila. A lot of people want to interpret that in the other verses that make reference to this, that he slept with Bila. But no, there are others that say he didn't sleep with her. What he did was move her bed in a particular tent, because now Rachel, who is his favorite, was gone, and Reuben wanted Bila to be in that place. And so if you look at the Hebrew, well, there's some argument to this. I can't prove it. But again, we're not trying to climb around in the tree of knowledge, but don't be too quick to judge Reuben as sleeping with Bila. That may not be what that verse means. But if you want to believe that, you can believe that. The important thing is that you do not blaspheme the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit was trying to tell you what the true meaning of Israel is, the true way of Israel, the true journey you should be on to become Israel, which, you know, I just heard several scholars talking about Jerome. Jerome says that the church replaced Israel. Now, we've got all these words, names flowing around, Israel this and the church and all that kind of stuff. But what's the true church? What's true Israel? Well, they should be doing the same thing. If they're following Abraham, if they're following Jacob, if they're doing what Jacob's doing, then they really, you know, this is what Christ came to teach us, how to live by faith, hope, and charity, not force, fear, and fealty that make you merchandise. But if you're going to engage in covetous practices, which Paul tells you is idolatry, then you're going to become merchandise. You're going to become human resources again. Maybe you've already done that. Many people have. I don't know where you're at. But we have articles on merchandise and human resources and what that would look like. It would look like bondage. But maybe it won't look like that to you, because maybe you're sitting in darkness, the same as the people at the time. They didn't think they were in bondage when they created a system of Corban. You know, the Pharisees and Herod got together and created a system of Corban. But Jesus said it made the word of God to none effect. Well, what is Corban? A system of sacrifice. Jacob is creating a system of sacrifice, but not like the Corban of the Pharisees and Herod, or Nimrod and Terah, nor Abimelech and the fathers of the earth, because Abimelech, that's what it means, father king. And we'll see later in the following chapter where Esau is creating kings and dukes. What's a duke? But anyway, we'll see that when we get to it. So we're seeing here where he's talking about the family. And the sons of Leah, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. And, you know, I'll create links here on this page at Preparing You, because I've already got articles on Simeon, Levi, Judah. They're very limited little articles so that you can see who these guys were, because they all had certain traits. They will all play certain parts, and we've talked about it in recordings we already have. And you can look that up and see for yourself what these all mean. But so the sons of Bela was Rachel's handmaid. Bela was Rachel's handmaid. Were Dan and Naphtali. And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's handmaid, were Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob, which were born to him in Padanaram. And Jacob came unto Isaac, his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. Had to be a huge amount of conversations between them. I don't know what state Isaac was in, but, he supposedly lives to be 180 years old. And at least it says in the very next verse, the days of Isaac were 104 score years. That's old. But we'll talk more about this when we return to Keys of the Kingdom. Well, welcome back. So the final verse in this chapter is about Isaac being 104 score years old. And it says, and Isaac gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days. And his sons, Esau and Jacob, buried him. So they went somewhere and they buried him. And, there's whole legends about the secret place that they buried him and all this stuff. They knew the country. But, I have on our page there, a little bit about, the days of Isaac, like I say, were 104 score, in that verse 28. And Isaac is 40 years old when he marries Rebekah. He was already 40 years old, but it was 60 years old when she gave birth to Jacob and Esau. And so Jacob then is 77 years old. This is the chronologies that people have calculated. If you go to Genesis 25, 24 through 26, he's 77 years old. So therefore Esau is 77 years old as well, when they deal with the issue of the blessing. And of course, Jacob ends up fleeing, going to the place where Laban lives. He sees Rachel, but he works 7 years before he marries Rachel, but then gets tricked by Laban to marry Leah instead. He's given another week with Leah, and then he marries Rachel. He gets her too, but now he's in debt for 7 years. He could have walked away any time during the first 7 years and not married anybody. But he made a commitment and he stuck to it, worked the 7 years, found out he was cheated. He made a deal, I'll work another 7 years if, you let me marry Rachel as well. At least that's kind of Laban's idea. Because he wants him around, because he knows whatever he does blesses him. He's 84 years old when he finishes that contract. But then he signs another contract to go in debt again, but now he wants to go away with his wife, Leah and Rachel, and he wants to take something with him because he came with virtually nothing. And all the stuff he had, he left back with Esau. So the only thing he got was the blessing from God. So then he works, but this time he's learned high finance with Laban, somebody who is not honest and therefore does not know God. And he comes out with a lot of livestock. And unbeknownst to him, evidently, I'm not sure how much he knew or didn't know, but Rachel had snuck away the statues of authority that were tucked away in the vaults of Laban. And when he went to get them to shear his sheep, to shear the people, somebody had stolen them. And so I don't know what he did to resolve that. He's the son of Nahor. And Nahor was the heir to the throne of Haran. So those statues were important. They were passed down to him from his father, Terah, who was an idolater. And he also was an idolater. In other words, they operated covetous practices where the people were human resources. But anyway, the ages here are remarkable. A lot of people won't believe it, but that's the way it seems to calculate out. I've looked at a number of different calculations, and some of them vary slightly. But Isaac would be 137 years old at the blessing, and 144 when Jacob married. And Jacob, during the second 7 years, if I got the math wrong, people get a hold of me, period with serving Laban, produces 11 of his 12 sons and his only daughter. And that's, you know, Genesis 29 and 30. And was 91 years of age, and Isaac was 151 years of age during this particular point. Let's see, is that? And Joseph was 6 years old, and the other children are between 6 and 13, and God commanded him to return. So, okay, so he was 97 when he was told to return. Yeah, okay. And so, I mean, he's getting up there. That's pretty old. But then Jacob was 107 or 108 years old when Joseph was sold into bondage by his brothers. And Isaac would have been about 167 years old. Consequently, and you don't, I never really put this together until last night about midnight. So that if my math is off, that he had to spend about a dozen years, maybe 13 years with Jacob living in close proximity during that period where Joseph is in bondage. But of course, that bondage was arranged by God to teach Joseph things and eventually bring Israel and Jacob's sons into bondage, not to save them from the famine, although it would, but because in bondage they would learn some of the lessons that they needed to learn to truly become Israel. So if at the end of this show or during this show or previous to this show, you may begin, or if you listen to us on X, at His Holy Church on X, if you come to our X space tomorrow, and you find out you're in bondage, what you want to ask, everybody wants to ask, how do I get out of bondage? But what you want to ask is, what am I supposed to learn now that I'm in the bondage? Because what you're supposed to learn is what will truly set you free. Because it, what sets you free? the truth sets you free. So one of the truths is, if you are in bondage, you have to admit that you're in bondage. You have to stop blaming it on everybody else and start realizing your part in that bondage and start learning the lessons that God wants you to learn so that you can be set free, because God's going to set you free. And the way you get set free is you follow the ways of Israel, which are the ways of Moses, which are the ways of Melchizedek, and are the ways of Christ. And a lot of people tell me they believe in Christ and they're following Christ, but they're not actually going the way of Christ, and their garments aren't really all that clean. So they want to clean their garments and escape from the cities of oppression, the cities of blood, the civil cauldrons of society that men create for themselves. Civil law is the law that men create for themselves. Natural law, the Creator created it. It already exists. You can't escape it unless you escape nature. But nature is, before God created the physical world, there was the spiritual world. So most people who escape the physical world just end up in the spiritual world. And what you do in the physical world will have a great deal of an effect on where you wake up at in the spiritual world. And people have all kinds of, there's a lot of worshiping of ideas about heaven and hell and what it's going to be like, and people want to know. And people are always talking about how wonderful it's going to be in heaven and how everything's going to be so beautiful and everything. You be careful they're not a bunch of ear ticklers, because you may not be going where you think you're going, because you may be under a strong delusion. And I've mentioned this again, and I'll add all the links to articles on these subjects so you can check for yourself. I mean, we have a Christian checklist. You can go down the Christian checklist and find out if you're really a Christian, because a lot of people are saying that they're Christians and are not. And Jesus told us that a lot of people would say that they're Christians and they're not. And a lot of people would say they were anointed of God to preach the gospel, and they're not. So, you know, and I don't really know if it's important to you know who is who, but if you need to know, God will tell you, the same as he told Jacob what to do. He will tell you in your heart and in your mind. But you need to know the truth in order to know your heart and your mind. And you need to know the truth about yourself in order to know the heart and mind of God. So this idea, you know, is repeated again. Go up to Bethel, go up to the house of God. Because you could write Bethel there, or you could translate it and say the house of God. And I will make there an altar unto God in the way which I went. So this is very important. What was this altar for? Because God don't need burnt sheep. That altars are a way in which societies, they were a gathering of stones is a gathering of men, a gathering of friends, same word in the Hebrew, and your sacrifices on those altars were a part of your love for one another. You give something to the men who man those altars, and they redistribute it to other people. If you gave it direct, which you can anytime you want, then you can claim credit for it. But if you give it up entirely, if it's a burnt offering that you give up, we have articles that show you that burnt offerings are something given up entirely. And it was given in the hands, in the reins of control of certain men who were eventually called priests of society. But in Abraham's time and Jacob's time and Moses' time, you gave to those men, you tithed to those men according to their service. They didn't come with a badge or a little statue and say that I have the authority of Nimrod to collect your taxes, or I have the authority of Laban to shear you, to take a portion of what you have for the common good, for the betterment of society. I have that authority. That's a different system than Moses was setting up, a different system than Abraham was doing. It's different than what Jacob was doing. It's certainly different than what Melchizedek was doing. When he brought, who bought the wine and bread that Melchizedek brought to the battle to supply the troops? They ended up not really needing it, but I'm sure they took some. But who paid for that? It came out of the tithes that were given to Melchizedek by men like Abraham and Joshua and Jacob and others who were faithful. It was free will offerings. Because if you're not operating according to the perfect law of liberty, free will offerings, faith, hope, and charity, then your alternative is just to wing it yourself or to sign up with the ones who exercise authority one over the other. And of course, anybody who's a Christian knows that Christ said you're not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who exercise authority one over the other but call themselves benefactors. Because that's what David is calling the tables that should have been for your welfare but are actually a snare and a trap. What Peter says, through covetous practices, they will make merchandise of you, human resources. So, again, we can go back to this. They're putting away their strange gods. The badges that say I am entitled to welfare by this group or that group, because I gave in the past. I mean, there's great distances involved here, but and he's setting up altars. He's going to set up altars in more than one place. Moses did the same thing. And if the altars are living stones, just like they were with the church, and they were that originally, which we have whole books and articles that take you through this step by step and show you the words. But ultimately, I don't want you to believe by the knowledge that we share with you. I want you to believe because the Holy Spirit is telling you that if I don't live by faith, hope, and charity, why would I expect to be free? If I'm willing to put a yoke of bondage on my neighbor to guarantee a social safety net in the system of governance I create, whether democracy or a totalitarian dictatorship or whatever, if I'm willing to put a yoke of bondage on my neighbor to be free of want myself, isn't that a form of wantonness? Isn't that lusting after the goods of my neighbor? Isn't that a covetous practice? And if I'm willing to put him into bondage, wouldn't the law of nature eventually bring me into bondage as well? And I will be sealed in that bondage by my consent. And my consent is evident because I eat at those tables. And if you don't want to eat at those tables, you don't want to give your consent, then you have to create an alternative system. And that's what Jacob is showing you. That's what Moses showed the people. They weren't going to be able to eat. Of course, they weren't going to be able to eat at the table of the Pharaoh anymore. He was cutting them off. They were still going to have to pay their tally of brick, but they weren't going to get the benefits. There's a great deal of effort trying to guarantee the benefits that come to people in the United States and many other countries. But economically, everybody's getting crunched because of another sin where we all decided to have one purse, which they talk about in Proverbs. And I already have a link on here where people want to have these flesh pots, these cities of blood, these civil cauldrons, where we all be one purse. And it's a snare and a trap. It always has been a snare and a trap. The Bible tells us this in verse after verse after verse, over and over and over again. And it makes the Word of God to none effect because it's literally idolatry. So anyway, they end up saying, we're not going to go those ways of Babylon, those ways of idolatry. And if we have any of these statues, we're going to give them up. And we have the evidence of our membership in these systems, our earrings. We're going to give those up too. And we see the word Hey, Nun, Zayin, Mem, Yad, Mem written there instead of what the normal word for earring, which is Nun, is it Nun, Zayin, Mem. Just those basic three letters. But that could mean any kind of, actually normally it's translated earring, but it can also mean jewelry because it's translated jewelry, jewels like three times. But it can mean a ring, a nose ring. And of course these things like nose ring, bulls have nose rings to control the bull. Earrings has always been a sign of slavery, bondage. We see, we have articles on ornaments. And these ornaments were also part of those systems to identify you as a member. And that's why they add these, the extra Yod Mem, divine spark, the flowing of the divine spark. You're going to break off those earrings, those things that bound you to those systems. Whether it's a physical earring or not, it's really not important. Whether it's buried under a physical oak or not, the oak tabernacle, and I'll quote here from, you know, just a commentary. There's lots of different commentaries. The Cambridge Bible School and College has a commentary where the oak or terebinth, and it is noteworthy that Joshua, under the same oak of Shechem, oak of consent, and Joshua 24:26, testified against the primitive worship of strange gods. It's what we're giving you an idea of what these strange gods are. They're the idolatry. They are the systems. You know, the word gods just means ruling judge. So there are ruling judges in those systems. And if you're dependent upon those systems, there will be people that tell you how much to give, when to give, and what you're going to get back. Because they're the authority over those systems. And we see them in Joshua 24:2 and Joshua 24:14 and 24:23. And we'll go through those when we go through Joshua. But for the terebinth in Genesis 12:6, which we see it way back when we were in that, the same as the sacred tree is possibly mentioned in Judges 9:6. And we don't have time to go through all those same verses. But this burying of these idols, cutting yourself off, breaking the bonds that connected you with those things. Because I don't know why Rebecca, other than the fact that those were silver, that she stuffed them under her seat in a camel. She wanted to steal them. And she felt like she had been betrayed by her brother, who thought of her as an instrument, a tool for his own gain and wealth. And she was a bit jealous of his power and all that stuff. But this oak symbolizes strength and endurance and, according to ancient rabbinical writings, divine presence. So what they're doing is they're exchanging their dependence on these physical systems that actually bring them into bondage and are now going to bury their dependence upon those under the divine presence of the God that Jacob is talking to. We saw that back when Jacob says, you know, a guy tells him, we're going to leave. He goes and he calls his wives and says, look, God's telling me we're going to leave. He's cheated us. His countenance has changed. And God wants me to leave. I've known that his countenance has changed, but now God says leave. I'm going. And they say, if God is telling you, we will go. And this is what he's putting to them again. We're going to bury our dependence on these other things under the presence of the same God that is appearing to me in my heart and in my soul and telling me what we need to do. He's following this spirit of God in him. And that's the tree of life that he's beginning to follow. and these burying their emotional dependence upon these statues and these outward physical symbols, and we're going to bury it under this spiritual walk. And when they walk in that way, then now the Tehat is going to protect them, make other people afraid, give them a divine protection. In the days ahead, you're going to want that divine protection. And while the normal word is, like I say, we actually see it written a couple different ways. We see it as the Chet Tov Tov, but we also see Tov Chet Tov. And there's a reason why we see that particular form of the word. But it has to do with, it can be translated beneath the tree, but it also could be instead of or in place of. And forsaking one system for another system. And that's really what the whole oak tree is about. They're now going to trust in this tree of life, which is the true oak tree of righteousness and wisdom, according to the Spirit of God, that needs to speak to everybody individually. And this is what Christ is bringing to us in more modern Greek, so it's sometimes a little bit clearer. And there's been so many people messing with their private interpretation of the original Hebrew scripts that we see coming down to us supposedly from Moses, that people will argue, oh, Moses didn't write these, but he did. But until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.